Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 10th of September. Tonight at 8 p.m., the president will address the nation. He's going to outline his administration's strategy for ridding the world of ISIS. This happens to be the eve, of course, of the 13th anniversary of the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks. This hour, what is the president likely to say tonight, and actually has already said, to congressional leaders and to the press, and what do you think about the probable plans? Professor Robert Lieber is our guest. He's a professor in the Department of Government and School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. He's an authority on American foreign policy and U.S. relations with the Middle East and Europe, author of several books, including Power and Willpower in the American Future, Why the U.S. is Not Destined to Decline. He's given foreign policy issue advice to Al Gore in his 2000 presidential campaign, Bill Clinton in 1991. He was coordinator of Middle East issues for the Dukakis presidential campaign, foreign policy advisor to Senator Edward Kennedy in his run for the presidency, and he was advance man for the McCarthy for President national campaign staff. He has lectured all over the world, grew up in Chicago, received his undergraduate education at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, PhD at Harvard, and I also read that he had a walk-on part in the Alfred Hitchcock film North by Northwest. We'll get to that later on in the show. We welcome your phone calls. What do you think of what the president is likely to say this evening? What do you think our goal should be? And does what we've heard already seem to be a logical strategy, or do you find it problematic? Here is our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Professor Robert Lieber, thank you very much for joining us this hour.
Glad to be with you.
Doesn't it strike you as rather eerie and terribly sad that the president is giving this kind of address on the eve of the anniversary of September 11th?
Yes, it is. It's an eerie coincidence. I wouldn't go far beyond that. The more striking fact is that the fact that he finds himself in that situation totally contradicts his expectations and policies over the previous 5 years. That's something both of a personal and policy tragedy.
Mm-hmm. He is going to announce a plan of how to degrade and destroy ISIS, the Islamic State. Is this a huge task, in your opinion?
It has become a huge task at this point. If we had been more proactive over the last couple of years, I don't think we would be in this situation. I mean, you can never be sure because foreign policy is always made amidst uncertainty, and the region is a dangerous and unstable one. But I think a lot of observers, both including among both Democratic and Republican foreign policy experts, are critical and think that if the administration had been more forward-leaning, dealing with Syria, dealing with Iraq, supporting our allies, we might not find ourselves in the situation now in which so many observers see this as a very dangerous moment.
And when you say forward-leaning, what do you mean?
Well, forward-leaning in the following sense, in understanding that withdrawal from the Afghan and Iraq wars, ending those wars, as President Obama put so much emphasis on in his first, the beginning of his first and second terms as president, ending wars requires not just our side, but the adversary. So how you end a war can be as important as how you start a war. And the way in which the administration pulled out of Iraq left Iraq in a situation to be much more unstable than might otherwise have been the case. Of course, the actions by the Iraqi government under Maliki were deeply dysfunctional and created a lot of the immediate problem. But there's at least an argument that had the U.S. kept a certain number of troops there to act as an influence, a lever, and so on, this separation into bitterly, hatefully antagonistic ethnic groups and adversaries might have been mitigated. On the Syrian situation, conflict broke out in Syria in February 2011. That's 3.5 years ago. Almost from the beginning, voices at home and abroad called for help to moderate Syrian rebels. The administration gave lip service to this, but it really never provided much help. And even when the president said he would help and warned of red lines if Assad used chemical weapons and also said Assad had to go, none of that happened. The chemical weapons were used, and basically nothing happened. So what happened, the consequence, I think, is that both adversaries and allies in the region became convinced that there was not much to expect or fear from the United States, and the inaction in both places contributed to the worsening of both situations.
Mm-hmm. And when you say moderate Syrian rebels, you know, I'm kind of appalled. Maybe there are a lot of experts out there and they're just not people that the media is talking to. But can we identify a good number of moderate Syrian rebels? Do we even know who they are?
I think the fairest and most accurate critique against what I've just said is that it would have been very difficult for us to navigate this.
Mm-hmm.
That these are perilous waters. The differences run very deep. These are unstable and dangerous places, and the U.S. has come to grief in those regions before. So that's a fair criticism. But the fact is that the initial opposition to Assad was a peaceful and nonviolent. People just wanted less repression, more individual freedoms and liberalization. Bashar Assad came to power after the death of his father. He was a London-educated ophthalmologist. His wife was fashionable and appeared in one of the women's magazines, Vogue or Vanity Fair. And there was some hope that he would liberalize. But in fact, he continued the brutally oppressive ways of his father and that dictatorial regime. And in the initial uprisings against him, the demonstrations and so forth, people simply wanted very basic things, even just liberalization within the regime. The Assad's people, Assad himself, met that with killing and brutality. But in the initial weeks and months, much of the opposition was led by pretty secular people, very middle-class, upper-middle-class element. Now, you can argue, and you can certainly make the argument in Egypt, you can argue whether or not they would have been able to prevail as this thing wore on and as much more violent, dangerous, radical Islamist forces came into the picture. In fact, that's an argument in part that the administration has suggested, at least in informal asides. So there is a criticism, but we put it this way. We do know that the consequences of what would have happened in Syria are dire, with ISIS running all over the place, controlling vast areas of Iraq and Syria, controlling oil fields, threatening major towns and dams, threatening to prevail in both countries, and threatening its neighbors. That's a pretty awful situation. And the counter argument then would be, look, you can't be sure that intervening earlier to try to support moderates would have made the difference, but you could hardly have faced worse consequences than we have right now.
Mm-hmm. And yet it's understandable from people who have been grievously wounded, from the number of Americans who have died, from the length of our war in Iraq and also in Afghanistan, with little to show for either of those endeavors, that people would be and have been, until we saw the beheadings of the American journalists, fairly reluctant to get involved in another major endeavor there.
Certainly the point you make is valid, but only up to a certain point. And it's something the president was rightly and heavily criticized for, a speech he gave this past spring at the commencement, I believe it was at West Point or the Naval Academy, in which he seemed to suggest that the choices in American foreign policy were intervening with boots on the ground or doing nothing. And even key Democratic foreign policy thinkers were critical of that. The fact of the matter is, there's a huge continuum of things the United States can do between those two extremes, between basically turning a blind eye, saying pious things but doing nothing, versus fighting another Iraq war. And those start with economic measures and diplomatic measures. They continue on through covert means. They continue through advisors. They continue through providing non-lethal and lethal aid, weapons, the use of drone strikes, and so forth. And I think what most of those arguing for a more robust stance for the United States in Syria were not arguing for boots on the ground at all. They were arguing for aid to the rebels, advice, weapons, non-lethal as well as lethal aid, and so forth. And above all, a signal throughout the region about the importance of the kinds of outcomes that we think were so important, both for the region itself and for our own national interest.
Mm-hmm. Let's spend some time talking about ISIS, which at least to our eyes and ears didn't come to prominence until fairly recently. This appears to be a particularly barbaric, vicious, burying people alive, beheading people, just really a horrible, horrible
group.
Yeah,
you left out crucifixions.
And crucifixions. What is the origin of this? Is there any theology involved? Is there any complaint? Why are they so barbaric?
The word barbaric is right. People are often hesitant to use that language, but you cannot look at what they've been doing to their fellow Iraqis and Syrians, to fellow Muslims, as well as Christians and Turkmen and Yazidis, and let alone American journalists, without arriving at the conclusion. There have been pictures, for instance, both videos on the web and in still photos of the massacres of surrendered, Iraqi as well as Syrian troops have sometimes surrendered to these guys by the hundreds, even thousands. And in many cases, they've simply been brutalized and then executed in cold blood. Now, you asked a very good question. Where did this outfit come from? ISIS, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, had an earlier beginning. It was one of a number of very radical, violent Islamist sects and movements, but it made its main impact in Iraq in the period around 2005 and 2006, 2007. It was at a time when the situation in Iraq, this is after the U.S. forces and the coalition forces had defeated Saddam Hussein in 2003, had carried out the military operation quite well, but had badly bungled what to do after the fall of Saddam. And there were a series of unstable governments, and the dangerous, brutal splits among Kurds, Shiites, and Sunnis, with terrible human rights violations, particularly between militias of the Sunnis and Shiites, paying each other for real and past, as well as rumored sins. Saddam Hussein had run a Sunni-dominated regime in a country that was about two-thirds Shiite. And the Sunnis were very uncomfortable with being in a minority. They had always expected to rule. In the context of this disarray, the violence among these different movements that took place, the killings, the bombings, this outfit in in the Sunni areas of Iraq, the Islamic State in Iraq, became increasingly prominent, took over large areas, some of which now ISIS controls. What was fascinating, though, is that they were so violent that al-Qaeda began to denounce them, saying that they were alienating the local population. And ultimately, when the Bush administration and General Petraeus carried out the so-called surge, which was both to add 30,000 more American troops, but also change the entire way in which U.S. and coalition forces were being used, it also, equally important, if not more important, involved engaging the so-called Sunni tribes in what was called the Awakening. And the those 100,000 or so of the Sunni tribes became fighting men paid by the United States. They were carefully vetted, they were armed, they were advised, and they were the ones who successfully carried out the fighting against what was al-Qaeda in Iraq, or these, the predecessor of this group. Now, the way they alienated people was multiple. They, for example, moving to these communities, would insist on marrying off the daughters of, in some cases, of local leaders to their people. And often their people were not even Iraqis, but fighters who had come from elsewhere in the region or even from outside the region. They would treat women with incredible brutality, decapitating little girls going to school and putting their heads at intersections to discourage girls from going to school. They muscled in on the smuggling. They forbid smoking and drinking. Some of those parts of the population were not very religious. And that, coupled with the sign that the Americans were now serious, were supporting this rearming of the tribes, with paying them and telling them that once this was over in a reconfigured Iraq, the Sunnis would be treated fairly, that led to the temporary defeat of the predecessor of ISIS. The problem is that since the U.S. withdrew, basically lock, stock, and barrel in 2011, the then government under the Shiite leader Maliki, almost from the day we left, began oppressing the Shiites and Kurds, seeking to arrest or actually arresting some of their leaders who were part of his government, arresting, imprisoning, exiling, or even killing some of the key leaders of these tribes, and effectively trying to turn Iraq into an exclusively Shiite-dominated state instead of recognizing the importance of running a pluralistic system in which you don't alienate these other major groups, the Kurds and Shiites. And he created such disarray that it resulted in these explosions which have followed. And that's part of the situation in which we find ourselves. The other part is the way in which the radical jihadists under ISIS have played an increasing role in Syria, where in the absence of stronger external support for more moderate forces, they gain that support from funders elsewhere in the region, as well as from kidnapping, bank robbery, extortion, and so forth. And they are the ones now making the running.
We're going to welcome phone calls, and here's how you reach our conversation. Professor Robert Lieber is our guest this hour, and we're talking about what the president is likely to outline tonight in his address to the country, in which he talks about ridding the world of ISIS. Professor Lieber is in the Department of Government and School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. He's an authority on American foreign policy. He has lectured all over the world and has given foreign policy issue advice to a number of presidential candidates, author of several books, including Power and Willpower in the American Future, Why the U.S. is Not Destined to Decline. Here's how you reach our conversation. What do you think about the role of the United States in seeking to destroy the Islamic State, how this can be done? We've yet to talk about the countries like Turkey. Turkey, I guess they've said that they would help us, but they're holding back because ISIS is holding some Turkish citizens hostage as well. But another big question that we'll ask our guest is, what should we ask of those who are in the region that are perhaps more directly affected by the ISIS threat than we are? And, of course, because we are here and we've already been hit before, we always ask the questions, what are the threats to us? We'll be with you momentarily. 800-486-8655 is the number, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. President Obama speaks to the nation tonight to outline the administration's strategy for fighting ISIS in the Middle East. We will have NPR's coverage of the speech, followed by discussion and also analysis from NPR reporters. This is an hour-long special. It begins at 8 o'clock this evening, and you can hear it on Wisconsin Public Radio. And we're talking about some of the issues that will be brought up by the president during this important speech tonight. And welcoming your phone calls for Professor Robert Lieber. We'll start our phone calls with John in Dykesville. Hi, John.
Hi there. First of all, I'd like to thank the professor for a wonderful review of the history of the problem. My question is this. We mentioned Turkey and other nations or countries in the region and what they could do to fight ISIS. And I'm wondering if we have to get Germany, Britain, well, Italy's a basket case, but some of the European nations involved, because I don't think that the folks who are in closer proximity can really do the job. And I'd love to hear your discussion, and I'll get off the air.
Thank you, John. Thanks for the call.
Well, John's asked an excellent question. I think it's a fair one, and it's the toughest challenge. The U.S. is the most powerful country in the world, but it shouldn't and can't do everything by itself. The question is, what's our comparative advantage? Where can we really make the difference, and how will others react to it? One of the problems is that ISIS has been encouraged and even funded by some of its neighbors, or at least elements among some of its neighbors. Countries like Qatar, for instance, and individual figures in some of the adjacent countries have helped to funnel funds to them. ISIS has also benefited from a kind of nihilistic mystique, appealing to deracinated young second-generation young Muslim men in Europe who, unlike their parents, who came as immigrants and appreciate what they've achieved in the society, feel lost and don't identify as well with the countries they're in and who are susceptible to these appeals. Turkey has played an especially difficult role here. Turkey has been the access point for fighters coming into Syria. Some of them, the more moderate elements, but very large numbers of them used of the most radical, violent, and to be blunt, barbaric elements have used Turkey as a transit point for weapons, for money, for moving people, for medical care, and so forth. And the Turks are only now beginning to see the threats to themselves and to take stronger action. But as was mentioned in the lead-in to the program just now, the ISIS has captured in taking over one of the major towns in northern Iraq. ISIS captured a group of Turks, Turkish diplomats and their children and others. They hold several dozen people, including kids. And there's a fear on the part of the Turks that if they're too forthcoming, their people may meet a dire fate. So there's that element. But there needs to be buy-in by the neighboring countries who are definitely at risk. Mm-hmm. Jordan has served as a training ground for moderate Syrians, some of whom have received a modicum of support from the United States. The Saudis and Egyptians and the United Arab Emirates are clearly worried and would be in a position to help. And press leaks on this, including a piece at the beginning of this week, suggested that the president might be announcing a collaboration between the U.S. And about 7, 8, or 9 other countries, including a number of the key Europeans plus Turkey.
Mm-hmm. What about Saudi Arabia?
Saudi Arabia is very important. They have a powerful air force. They see themselves as vulnerable in a number of ways. And the role of the Saudis, whether it might be in providing air power, providing advisors, or funding, or what have you, can be important. But a broader point I want to make about American foreign policy is the leadership role of the United States. The most dangerous, most violent quarrels often can only be dealt with effectively if the U.S. is involved somehow. Again, that doesn't mean necessarily boots on the ground. Usually it doesn't. But a lot of these countries have been covering their bets. They've been deeply concerned at what they have seen as American retrenchment, withdrawal, and disengagement. And to the extent they see the U.S. as buying in some way, that is with financial support, advising, weapons, drone strikes, maybe air power, the more likely they are to take risks themselves. But most of them are very reluctant to expose themselves to the full fury of ISIS and those who support it unless they know the United States has their back.
Chris is our next caller in Milwaukee. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. These wars are the gifts that keep on giving, anyhow, for arms dealers. I believe the only way to achieve peace is through peace. In the 1960s, we had war. Tens of thousands of young Americans, how many Vietnamese, died. More were injured. We had leaders assassinated, university buildings bombed. What happened? All songs became songs of peace and love. Peace was our greeting. It was a sign that we wore. I believe that more war only leads to more war. And I may sound foolish, but is it more foolish than fighting enemies who stole our weapons and are using them against us?
Well, it's an admirable sentiment and an admirable wish. And over the centuries, over the millennia, there have been religious and ethical and other figures, cultural figures, who've proclaimed that. But the tragedy is that is not the world that we live in. We don't live in a world in which that situation obtains. President Obama, supported by the American people, wanted to end two wars. But it's not just up to us to end the war. It depends about what the other side has in mind. There was also, to be blunt, evil in the world. Think of Adolf Hitler. Think of the Japanese rape of Nanjing in 1937. Think of what ISIS is doing now. The U.S. has unique capacities, and we can't just bury our heads in the sand. You know, the notion of outlawing war was actually the subject of a treaty in 1928. This is a decade after the end of World War I, a war that had been so incredibly appalling in its consequences. More than 60 countries, led by the American Secretary of State Kellogg and the French Foreign Minister Briand, signed the Kellogg-Briand Treaty to outlaw war. And the countries who signed it agreed to forego war. Well, we know how that worked out. By 1939, Europe was in flames, and in 1941, we were attacked at Pearl Harbor and drawn into the war. So we have to separate the difference between ought and is, and we have to face the world as it is, even while keeping our own ideals and hopes in mind.
So when we go back to what our goals are and what the president is going to be outlining tonight, do you see what's being most effective in destruction of ISIS would be airstrikes in Syria, airstrikes in Iraq? It's hard to imagine are getting up to speed any Iraqi soldiers in the amount of time that it might take. They haven't been very useful so far. That would have to be the way to go. The other thing may not be very promising, is it?
We face a very difficult situation. And statements made in the last couple of weeks by Vice President Biden, Attorney General Eric Holder, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dempsey, have said this is really an extremely dangerous situation. And I think in fairness to President Obama, the policy choices now are very difficult ones, mm-hmm. and this is not an easy situation to get a handle on. And we'll know more after the president speaks tonight at 8 p.m. Central Time. If you ask, what are people who live and breathe foreign policy talking about, what do they think would be the best way to cope with this? It would be that the U.S. provides weapons, advice, drone strikes, the use of air power, but that the people on the ground have to be the locals. We're not likely to be as effective putting our own Americans on the ground. The public doesn't want American troops on the ground, but there has also been a dramatic turnaround in American public opinion, which has been striking. A year ago, public opinion showed that for the first time since the beginning of the Cold War in the late 1940s, a majority of Americans basically wanted the U.S. to stay out, not just in the Middle East, but of foreign affairs more broadly and foreign interventions. Those numbers have been dramatically changed in recent weeks and days. The Washington Post on Monday of this week ran their poll, which showed that 71% of Americans now favor the use of American air power against ISIS. Mm-hmm. That's a striking turnaround. But you can't just do it all from the air. The air power is an extremely important part of this. And one tragedy is a lot of the things we'll be knocking out are ISIS fighters using American tanks and armored personnel carriers and heavy weapons that they captured when four divisions of Iraqi troops in northern Iraq simply collapsed, ran away, because many of them simply did not share the beliefs and loyalties to the Shiite-dominated central government in Baghdad. So you need reform of the government in Baghdad. They have a new prime minister, which is extremely important, who is starting to appoint members of the leaders of the other communities to his cabinet. That's not yet a done deal. He's made some appointments. There are other key ones. But he's talking in a way that no Iraqi leader has been doing since Maliki took power.
Mm-hmm.
So that's crucial. So, again, the U.S. role is pivotal to show that American power and attention are committed. But our role mainly needs to be in terms of the strategic use of the things we do best, drones and air power, advice, weapons, equipment, probably some kind of spotters and special forces in advisory roles. But mainly it's the locals, rearming the Iraqis, getting these Sunni tribes to turn against ISIS. It looks as though in the last year or two, the Sunnis so angered at the way they were being treated by the Shiite-dominated government in Baghdad, at first embraced ISIS, because ISIS is Sunni, and so forth. But now there is good reason to believe that yet again they've seen ISIS as being far too brutal and repressive, and it's at least conceivable and to be hoped that they can be persuaded to change sides yet again. But note my comment about changing sides. This is a dangerous, volatile region in which there are layers and layers and layers to this, and one has to be wary of what the U.S. can do best and what hazardous terrain it's not well placed to navigate.
Right. Abel in Milwaukee. Hi.
Yeah, I remember when Nixon bombed Cambodia and then it led to the Pol Pot. We do not have the ability to do everything, but what happened afterwards was Vietnam went in there after a few weeks. They got rid of Pol Pot once and for all. They fought man-to-man, soldier-to-soldier, and they got rid of him. I remember Jimmy Carter condemned Pol Pot as the world's worst violator of human rights, and a few months later, Vietnam went in there and got rid of him. We should not get involved in Iraq, I think. I think the best country to go after Iraq right now would be Iran. We should just sort of quietly, stay out of that. This risk of blowback, and then this will elevate.
All right. Well, what is the risk of blowback if we did nothing, Professor?
Well, we're already at risk. People involved in intelligence, the military and so on, are already warning that there's an enormous potential risk. It's thought not yet to be at the scale of what 9/11 involved, that ISIS for the moment is focusing on what they call the near enemy. But certainly in their rhetoric and so forth, they represent a threat to everything the U.S. represents. They represent a threat particularly to the Europeans, because hundreds or even thousands of young European men, both second-generation people who are of the Muslim faith, but also some non-Muslims who've converted, have European passports. They will eventually be returning to Europe, and it is feared that some of them could very well be the shock troops of ISIS plots, threats, terrorism, what have you, in Europe itself. The issue of Iran is an example of the very, very complicated layers here. Right now, the Iranians have been deeply engaged in the region, and they are a threat not only to ISIS, but also to us and to our allies. The Iranians are the key backer of Hezbollah, the Lebanese Shiite militia, and Hezbollah have been the shock troops for the Syrian regime of Assad, fighting against largely Sunni and other rebels against him. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps elements have fought in Syria and are now present in Iraq itself. And Shiite militias, both from Iraq itself and apparently also advised or even led by Iranians, have been fighting in Iraq against ISIS. So we find ourselves in an uncomfortable situation where we and the Iranians, at least now, are fighting the same adversary.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be a mistake to conclude that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. The enemy of my enemy is also my enemy in this case.
And these young people who are going from Europe and some from the United States to join these killers is what? Why are they going?
That's a huge and very difficult question. Also, let me say that the numbers from Britain, France, the Netherlands, Belgium, and so on are much greater than from the United States. From the United States, it's been a relative handful, but you have had some cases, for instance, of deracinated, alienated young Somali men in Minnesota,
mm-hmm.
who traveled there and were killed in the fighting in Syria or northern Iraq. The case of these two young men from Minnesota, one a Somali immigrant who was not, I believe, a Somali immigrant who was not religious. The other, a young white kid, were pals in high school. Both were increasingly troubled in school, dropped out, smoked a lot of dope, got into trouble, and at some point found meaning in their lives in extreme radical versions of Islamism, converted, often themselves knowing very, very little, almost nothing about what it all meant, traveling to the region and getting in way over their heads in something they didn't, let's say, fully comprehend. In Europe, you have the situation where, in the case of, say, Britain, Pakistani workers came to Britain in the 1950s and 60s to work in industrial and textile plants and so forth. For many of the people who did that, it was a movement for greater prosperity, for greater political freedom, for a better way of life. But and many of them are well integrated into British society. But a certain number of their sons and a few of their daughters feel increasingly alienated. You see that with the London bombings of 2005, where four young men from the Indian subcontinent, Pakistan, were involved in these suicide bombings on the underground and on buses that killed about 50 people. And the British and the French have seen hundreds and hundreds of their young men take trips to Turkey, go through Turkey and into the fighting in Syria and now in Iraq. In some cases, you get the sense they didn't have an idea of quite what they were doing, but in a situation where they weren't doing well educationally, felt alienated from society, didn't have the perspective their parents had, were kind of adrift between the society in which their parents had grown up in the region and the society in which they were living in. It's that fracture line that's involved here. And there has to be a way of finding better ways to integrate and absorb those people.
I would say
generally,
so.
The U.S. has done a much better job in that respect. We're a much more open society.
Thank you, Abel, for your call. Bill in Marshfield, hi.
Oh.
Yes, Bill.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to address the professor to address again the fact that there's been massive public opinion against further involvement in Syria up until the last couple weeks. And it seems like ISIS just baited us into this with these horrific videos of beheadings. But we didn't get so excited about all the other beheadings and crucifixions that have been going on as far as getting personally involved. And also, he quotes or he seems to identify foreign policy experts as knowing that there were groups of moderates that we could have identified and armed, and yet I've never seen any actual plan come forth either from the Congress or the Senate or any other experts. They just allude to this, but they never name anybody.
Yeah, it's a good point. Professor?
Those are good questions. Let me try to answer those concisely. On this issue of intervention and then on public opinion, the idea early on, I mean, by the way, I don't want to convey the impression that all foreign policy experts inside or outside the government or in academia or the think tanks were agreed on this. From the beginning, there were deep divisions over what to do in Syria. Certainly, there were plenty of people who said stay out, thought that, let the two sides fight it out. We don't like either side. Just stay away from it. I think that policy of benign neglect has not helped us and certainly hasn't helped the region at all. It's made it more dangerous and more threatening to our friends and allies in the region and our interests there. There were various proposals, some expressed by the president himself. A few months into this, the president said that Assad must go. Well, apparently Assad didn't think much of that and ignored it. The president also said the international community must step up. He warned a couple of times about the consequences of Assad's use of chemical weapons. If Assad even moved, let alone used chemical weapons, he would be crossing a red line. That happened, and we did nothing. The consequence of doing nothing is to greatly undercut your credibility. And credibility matters in world affairs, because a lot of what we do involves not only deterrence of people from doing bad things, but reassuring our friends and allies that we have their back. The point is, the proposals that we would begin helping the Syrian moderates, which were set a couple of times by the president himself and by members of the administration, never really took shape, except in the most in very small, inconsequential ways. About public opinion often changes slowly, and sometimes it takes the catalyst of a deadly, dramatic event to change that. Think of Pearl Harbor, which ended isolationist sentiment in the United States and propelled us into World War II. It's not just Pearl Harbor itself, but finally a recognition by the public that the stakes were enormous, and it was lethal for us. It would have been lethal if the Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan had prevailed. The 200,000 Syrians are now dead. ISIS controls vast land areas, is threatening its neighbors, controls some oil fields, and if we thought Al-Qaeda and the Taliban were bad, if ISIS consolidates control in these countries, which I think we will be able to prevent, they would control population, territory, wealth, and weaponry, which would be a real threat not only to our allies and friends in the region, but to Europe and to ourselves. And I think it took a catalyst for the American public to recognize this. It wasn't just the beheadings of two American journalists, although those were, I think, had a huge impact, but it was also the way that this minority Yazidi population mm-hmm. was trapped on a mountaintop, and with the likelihood that terrible things would happen if they were overrun, which they were about to be, as well as a realization that if we didn't intervene, the Kurds, who've carved out an area of a quasi-state with a lot of decency and achievements, would also be jeopardized if something wasn't done.
Professor Robert Lieber is our guest. We have a few more minutes with him. He's professor in the Department of Government and School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. He's the author of Power and Willpower in the American Future, Why the U.S. is Not Destined to Decline. He's given foreign policy issue advice to a number of presidential candidates, has lectured all over the world, and got his undergraduate degree at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and PhD at Harvard. More phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A reminder, as we're talking about these issues this hour, President Obama will speak to the country tonight. He'll be giving us his strategy for fighting the militant group ISIS in the Middle East. We will be broadcasting NPR's coverage of the speech, followed by discussion and also analysis from NPR reporters. It's an hour-long special beginning tonight at 8 o'clock on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, Pew Research Center did an interesting study about who runs for office. Did you know that there are something like 12,880 independent school district governments? There are county governments. There are a lot of possibilities, not just to run for office, higher office, but also to run for federal, local, or state elected office. And yet, only about 2% of Americans say they have ever run for office. Why is that? And why are the numbers particularly low when it comes to women and to minorities? That's coming up hour two of our show. All right, back to phone calls. Sarah and Zion, hi.
Hi. Hi, thank you. Okay, ever since this happened, you know, the beheadings, I was just wondering what, I mean, they say that they were warning the U.S. not to get involved, but obviously they are trying to provoke us into some sort of reaction. And then today on that earlier program, the guest was saying yeah, they're trying to get the U.S. to overreact. And I'm just wondering, what do you think their real goal was in those beheadings, and how is that going to benefit them? I mean, whatever reaction they want, how do they think that's going to benefit them?
Well, you don't want to deprive other actors of agency. They have their own motives, ideology, and so forth. Part of what they're doing and making it public is to terrorize. I mean, they have a very fascinating, you might say, cultural and media policy. They want to terrorize those who would oppose them, and they want to motivate those who would join them. There's a saying in the region that when people see a strong horse and a weak horse, they prefer the strong horse. Osama bin Laden, among others, had made that point. So they're trying to convey the sense of power and inevitability. Join us to create a caliphate in the region, the combination of melded secular and religious rule over the entire society under Sharia. Join us or else. And it can be a pretty powerful thing. A lot of people, most people may prefer to be left alone, but when they're faced with brutal choices, their survival instinct may kick in. And then there are those to whom these apocalyptic, even nihilistic aims appeal. That is, if you're not finding satisfaction and success in this world, you look for something in the next world. The mythic appeal, if you're a suicide bomber, in your death you will go, you will have 72 black-eyed virgins. By the way, that never really appears anywhere in any of the holy writings and so on of Islam, but it's a myth fostered by more credulous radical Islamists.
Let's go next to probably our final call. It'll have to be John in Madison. Hi, John.
Oh, hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
You know, in wrapping this whole thing up, I think as a country, we just are going to have to gird ourselves for endless war. I don't think this administration or the one prior to it really gave any thought to the long game on this. The minute that first infantry guy stepped across the border in 2003, the world changed, and it didn't change in a good direction for us. If we were able to really hold our elected officials accountable for their decisions, even when they're out of office, I would bet we wouldn't be having this conversation today. Those are my comments.
All right. Thanks, John. Professor Lieber.
Well, certainly the 2003 war had fateful consequences. But we're in a long game, whether we like it or not. As Henry Kissinger has said, Americans like to think that the default level of the world is peace. But international affairs, threats, never end. The U.S., for better or worse, remains the world's leading power. We have national interests that affect our very lives and prosperity and the future of our families. And whether we like it or not, many decades after the end of World War II, we still have troops in Korea and in Germany and in Japan. We simply do not have the option in pulling back into a fortress America. That was an idea mooted about in the 1930s, and it was disastrous. The real question is prudence. We can't do everything. We can't be the world's policeman, but we need to play an engaged role in our own national interest and that of a more stable, orderly, decent world. The question is one of judgment. Where do you do it and how do you do it? But the either-or choices, I think, are misleading. We don't have the option of doing nothing. And I also close with, ironically, with a reference to, there was once a statement a century ago which goes, it was from Leon Trotsky, the collaborator of Lenin in the Bolshevik Revolution, who was later murdered by Lenin. He was the creator of the Red Army, and his statement was, "You may not be interested in war, but war is interested in you." As we saw on 9/11, mind you, 12 years before 2003, the outside world comes to us whether we want it to or not. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thank you very much for being with us. And just in 15 seconds, was it fun to be in North by Northwest?
Oh yeah, I had a small walk-on part I was about a 16-year-old kid in Chicago,
oh.
And I signed a contract and was there for 2 days and was on screen for 10 seconds.
How much money did you make?
And I met Hitchcock. In those days, it was close to $100,
Woo.
Which back in those days was a lot of money.
Yeah.
My dad was the business manager for the talent agency, so I had an in.
And it's a great thing to have on the resume in addition to everything else. Thank you so much
right.
for being with
My
us.
My pleasure.
Professor.
I enjoyed talking with you.
Yeah.
Go Badgers.
Right. Thanks for being with us. Professor Robert Lieber, he's in the Department of Government and School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. He has advised many presidential candidates, and he is the author of Power and Willpower in the American Future, Why the U.S. is Not Destined to Decline. That's his most recent work. He's written other books as well. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to K.P. as well for on-air production in our studios here in Milwaukee. We have news coming up momentarily, which will be filled, I'm sure, with some of what we were talking about this hour, and we'll return with another hour and talk about why there aren't more women and minorities running for office in this country. What's the story? That's coming up.